Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
I have a very different approach to recruiting. Kind of word got out on the street that I was the new kid on the block in terms of recruiting, and started getting calls from the Benziger family, and then Diageo called, and then from there it just kind of kept on blossoming and slowly grown here to where I am 17 years later now.
What makes a good recruiter? What qualifications and traits does one must possess in order to do that job correctly?
Well, you said earlier, number one, you have to be very organized. Mm-hmm. You have to be able to, the way I like to describe it is you have to do something that the good executives do. You have to be able to telescope out to see the big picture, 30,000 foot view, think strategically, plan strategically, and then flip on a dime and be able to microscope down into the 6-inch problems and issues and topics and execution, and then be able to toggle back and forth between those two without getting tangled up in your underwear or tangled around the axle, as I like to put it. If you can do that, you've got a good shot at being a recruiter. You also have to be a good salesperson and more of like consultative selling. Like, there are a lot of recruiters in this industry and other industries who approach recruiting in what I call a transaction-oriented approach, where it's like they think, okay, there's an open seat on the bus, and all I need to do is get a warm body in that seat, collect my fee, and then I move on. Those kinds of recruiters are a dime a dozen, and they're a bit like used car salesmen, because they're not really focused on what's in the best interest of the client, what's in the best interest of the candidate. So the way I've been positioning Newland Associates is becoming a trusted advisor to clients who will actually step in and really get to know their company, their culture, their goals and objectives, their mission, their portfolio, and offer them counsel and advice that might be a little different than what they thought they were seeking in a recruiter and in a role. And then I also do that with respect to candidates, to become like a trusted career counselor to candidates, because sometimes they need coaching help in terms of how they're positioning their career, how they're packaging their resume, the way that they interview, those kinds of things. And so as a recruiter, you have to be able to work with two audiences. Clients is one audience and candidates is the other audience. And I think you've got to be also warm, personable, action-oriented, and you also have to be good at follow-up and follow-through and communication. The recruiters who are really good, I think, are very good at keeping both their clients and their candidates informed about where the process is and what everybody's status is in every stage of the process. The critiques that I hear from candidates about the recruiters that they don't like working with is when they're left in the dark, not knowing where am I in the process, and I'm even in the running, and half the times, the recruiters are not keeping them sort of informed of what's going on. So that's kind of at a high level, the traits and qualities and characteristics of a good recruiter.
You're describing almost like a matchmaking process.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and in fact, at one point, I explored, is there an opportunity to do like a Match.com or eHarmony for executive search? Because, the thing is, there are all of these, what they call psychometric-based personality assessment tools, like the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator that I got trained in eons ago. I use a tool called, the Drake P3, and it's a psychometric-driven profiling tool. And I thought, if I could develop or find an expert to develop a psychometric tool that could really understand the cultural dynamics and the chemistry of the people inside of the hiring company. And then we had the corresponding psychometric test for candidates. Maybe there's an opportunity to do a matchmaking sort of solution there. And there's some companies working on it. I've not seen anyone successfully crack the code on it yet, not like they do in dating services.
You mentioned that you're a different kind of recruiter. Is that what you meant by that? Is that your approach?
Sort of.
Okay.
So here's why I'd say I'm a different kind of recruiter. I was guilty of being a little bit of that kind of transactional-oriented recruiter when I first got started, because I got trained, not by my cousin. I worked with her for a few years, and then I moved on to another firm in Marin that was run by a former partner for one of the major, major recruiting, global recruiting firms called Heidrick & Struggles. And his philosophy was, it's all about the numbers. So you got to pick up the phone and talk to 100 people today in order to get to 50 who are going to, answer your phone, in order to get to 20 who are going to you know, be at the top of your funnel and you got to keep narrowing it down. And he was like a military drill sergeant, just driving, you know, cracking the whip on us. And that's not my style. I'm not a numbers kind of a guy. I'm more big picture and I'm more about personality and relationships. And so I lasted there all of 5 months and I ultimately had to move on. But I still bought into that notion because I was still kind of green in recruiting. But I ultimately burned out on my recruiting career in wine at the end of 2013. And it was really because I was running my business more from my left brain only. I wasn't accessing my right brain very much. And I wasn't accessing any kind of a balance between head and heart. I didn't know this at the time, but when I burned out at the end of 2013, my then wife, Colleen, and I, we were living down in Larkspur. I'd been recruiting in wine at that point for 12 or 13 years. And I was so fried. My mantra at that point was, I'm done with recruiting, I'm done with wine, and I'm done with California. And so we decided to sell our house, sell our cars, put everything in storage. We shipped some things over to Kauai. We decided Kauai was the place we wanted to go because we had gotten engaged there and we'd done our honeymoon there. We love that island. And the truth is, Colleen is a mermaid. She needs to be in salt water. And she had a neck condition, and all of her doctors and therapists had always told her that she would do much better in a hot, humid climate where she could swim in warm waters all the time because that would help to hydrate the discs in her neck. And so it was a no-brainer. Let's go to Kauai.
Yeah.
I had also done some spiritual work with an astrologer, believe it or not. There's a form of astrology called astrocartography. And based on the location of where you were born on planet Earth, and you have to believe in astrology first in order for this to make sense, but the location of the planets at the moment when you're born, which is really what sets a lot of the patterns of our lives, if you believe in astrology, it also determines where are the geographic locations on planet Earth, where you're going to be much more aligned and attuned with, let's say, success financially, or relationship success, or spiritual exploration, or whatnot. And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to talk to this woman. Her name is Maya White. She's down in Los Angeles. She's an amazing astrologer. And I had her do my astrocartography with one question in mind. I'm burned out. I need to go do some deep spiritual work and reflection. Where should I go? And the Hawaiian Islands was absolutely perfection for my particular astrological chart. So we sold the houses and we moved to Kauai. And the first 6 months there were like the perfect sabbatical. I mean, on the beach, hiking, and I got to know all the restaurants, and I got to know all the wine guys over there and all that. And about a year and a half into, actually I take back 6 months into it, I one day broke out with this full body rash. Had no idea what was going on. I went to the one and only dermatologist on the island, and he took one look at the rash and he said, "Hey, you've got mango, what did he call it? Mango rash, I guess." I said, "Well, what the hell is mango rash?" And he says to me, "Well, you know, he asked a different question first. He said, you're from the mainland, right?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Well, did you ever get poison oak or poison ivy as a kid?" I'm like, "Yeah, I got poison oak all the time." He's like, "Well, it turns out that the mango tree in these tropical climates comes from the same family as poison oak, poison ivy." Huh. "So I can guarantee you were probably climbing in a mango tree harvesting mangoes because they were ripe at that point in the year." And sure enough, 2 days before, I'd been up in a tree, harvested like 3 dozen mangoes and cut them up and, you know, froze some and gave some to the neighbors, all that. So anyway, the oils from the sap of the mango tree got on my skin and I got this rash. So anyway, I didn't think anything of it. He prescribed the standard antibiotics protocol, which is like 17 days of pills and a big shot. And sure enough, the symptoms started to subside. But on day 18, one day after it had finished, the rash started coming back and it was raging again. I went back to see him again. He said, "Okay, I'm going to do one more round of this and we'll hopefully knock it out. But there's three things that will keep irritating this. You've got to stop doing these three things. Number one, you have to stay out of the humidity. Number two, you have to stay out of the sun. And number three, you have to stay out of the salt water."
Oops.
Well, we're in Kauai, for Christ's sakes. Like, how do you live life? So I basically had to confine myself to our condo that we were leasing in air-conditioned environment. And so being holed up in that place, it forced me to figure out, okay, what am I going to do with all my free time now? So I started doing a deep dive into a bunch of interesting spiritual courses and whatnot on the internet. And my spiritual life opened up dramatically from all this work I started doing there. And at the end of the sort of this rash process, I finally said to my wife, because she had been a medical hypnotherapist, I said, what do you think there's something going on that between mind body that my unconscious mind is trying to communicate something to me that I'm not aware of, and it's coming out in a rash? And if you've ever, for anybody who is married to a therapist, sometimes it's not the best thing for the husband and wife to be doing therapy on one another.
Yeah.
So we decided that probably wasn't a good idea, but she suggested I call her mentor in hypnotherapy. So I reached out for this woman named Susie, and she said, look, write me an email and explain to me what's going on. Let me look at that and let's get on the phone. So I told her the whole story of what had been going on with burning out and recruiting and going to Kauai and then this rash. And so I get on the phone with Susie, and she says to me, as I'm reading your story, in my mind's eye, I'm seeing one picture loud and clear. And it's like your unconscious mind has a Louisville Slugger baseball bat in its hand, and it's clubbing you over the top of your head, trying to get your attention. And she said, so I'm going to ask you a question, but I want you to close your eyes, and I want you to get it really quiet. Close your eyes. And the question is, if there's something in my life that needs to change, what would that be? And she said, I want you to sit silently until an answer comes from deep inside. So I did, and I sat there in quiet for like 30, 40 minutes. And all of a sudden, that same voice that told me that I needed to pursue wine popped in, and it said, your marriage needs to change. And I kind of went, oh, shit, what do I do with this? Because I went on sabbatical thinking I was supposed to rest from burnout and change my career. This was a shocker of all shockers, and I wasn't even comfortable talking with Colleen about it at that point. So I did a lot more deep reflection and spiritual work around this, and what did that mean? And there's a guy named Joseph Campbell who, back in the 1990s, when Bill Moyers used to do his Sunday morning TV programs where he would talk to an expert, Joseph Campbell had, I think they called this The Power of Myth, was the Bill Moyers program. And Joseph Campbell was probably the number one world-renowned mythologist. He's the one who had discovered that if you look at all these different civilizations across the planet, even though they may have zero communication, like the Aborigines in Australia are going to have no communication with the Germanic culture in Germany, but if you look at the underlying mythological stories that inform members of the society as to what does it mean to be a human being and how do you go from one stage in life, let's say adolescence, to adulthood, the mythological stories are there to teach us through verbal tradition how we're supposed to evolve and sort of grow and become a fully functioning person in the society. And so Joseph Campbell was the guy who discovered all that. Well, he came up with this thing called the hero's journey. And the hero's journey turns out to be the storyline that Hollywood has used for all of the major blockbuster movies, things like Star Wars and The Matrix and all these major, major movies. And it goes something like this. You wake up one day and your life is no longer working the way it used to work, and you have a choice. You can stick your head in the sand and pretend like you don't have this new knowingness and try and limp along. The problem is the universe is going to keep waking you up until you get it that something's got to change. It's going to, first of all, maybe put you in a car accident or maybe some life-threatening illness. It's your unconscious. It's like the universe's way of trying to communicate with you that something's got to change. So a lot of people, I think, go to their grave not recognizing that's what some of these experiences are in their life. The other choice you have is to recognize, okay, something's got to change. And if you do, you're going to go on a journey that he called the hero's journey. And he called it hero's journey because it's going to be the most difficult journey you'll ever go on. And while, yes, there will be some experiences in the outer world, it's really a journey into the depths of who you are. And you will encounter your biggest fears, your biggest demons. You will discover there will be helpers along the way that will show up to guide you through the difficult moments. You'll wake up, in a sense, and you'll become a lot more of a whole individual. And on the other end of it, when you're finished with the hero's journey, the lessons that you've learned, your job will be to bring those to humanity and help other people to discover that this might be what's going on in their lives. So, and I'm going to bring this back to your question about why I approach recruiting differently. This was such a massive, massive challenge for me. It was so scary. It was so deep. It was so profound to realize that my marriage had to come to a close. I ultimately got comfortable with that, and I finally was able to sit down with Colleen and have a conversation with her one day and explain. And fortunately, Colleen and I had done a lot of spiritual work together. We had a deep respect for one another, a deep trust in one another, a deep honoring of our spiritual paths. And in fact, when we had gotten married, she was the one who suggested that we strike from our wedding vows that phrase, till death do us part, because she had been married once before. And on her spiritual journey, she had discovered that just because two people are on the path together as a married couple, if their spiritual journeys at some point in the future causes them to need to separate, they shouldn't necessarily feel constrained to one another because they've got this vow in their wedding vows that said, till death do us part. What if your spiritual journey is to separate and go separately? So she was the one who insisted upon that. I was a young, naive, you know, kid getting married for the first time. I had no clue, you know, what the implications of that were going to be, but it seemed like a good idea at the time. Well, little did I know that, you know, 18 years later, I would be the one who would ultimately need to honor that sort of agreement in our wedding vows. And so I sat her down one day and I explained that much like Luke Skywalker woke up one day and realized even though his parents had died, his aunt and uncle had raised him and he felt the deepest amount of love that he'd ever experienced in his life with his aunt and uncle. Obi-Wan Kenobi had come along and showed him that he had a bigger mission in life. He was being called to do something different than just stay on the farm with his aunt and uncle. And he honored it and pursued it and he went on that incredible journey. Now, I'm not saying I'm Luke Skywalker, but I had my version of that happen where this inner voice came to me one day and said, you need to bring your marriage to a close. It's not that you hate Colleen or vice. It's not that she does too much or too little of anything. You're being called on a journey that requires you to go it alone. And it's not going to be revealed to you. It's like the domino thing that I talked about earlier. I didn't know what was next, but in my meditations and getting prepared for separating from Colleen, I was also, that little voice came back and said, you need to go to Park City, Utah for the next stage of your sabbatical. No explanation why. I had learned to trust that voice and I'm like, okay, that's where I'm going next. So when I sat Colleen down and explained all this in a very, very comprehensive way, in a very honoring way, she surprised the hell out of me with how she reacted. And what she said was, she wasn't crying. She said, you know, first of all, I'm shocked. I can't believe this is what's happening. But I've never seen you be more articulate, confident, powerful, and congruent than what the way you are with me right now and what you're saying. How can I not honor what you need to go off and do? So of course I'm going to honor that. I don't know how I'm going to get through it. I don't know how we're going to get through it. So it was just the most amazing response to have my wife of 17 years respond in that kind of supportive way. And so it really set us off on what I would call the conscious uncoupling process, like Gwyneth Paltrow and Chris Martin went on their version of that. Colleen and I did our version of that. It was not easy. Colleen went into a very deep, dark place of grief and depression. It took her 4 years to really kind of get full circle. And the most amazing thing happened about 2 years ago. She shared a story with me when one day she was on the phone with one of her nieces. And her niece said something like, Auntie Col, aren't you angry at Uncle Dave for what he did to you? And fortunately, Colleen was spiritual enough to realize what was really happening was bigger than just a divorce. She said to her niece, you know, I don't think you understand. Uncle Dave didn't do anything to me. He did something for me. Because the shock of my needing to go off on my own and bringing our marriage to a close took Colleen to her knees and forced her to go so deep on her own hero's journey that she discovered all kinds of aspects about who she really is, what her real values are, what wholeness means to her. And she's now 4 years later popped down on the other side. She is in such an awesome place right now. She was literally just here 2 weeks ago for a couple of days. We love each other. We totally respect each other. We know we're going to be spiritual partners / friends for the rest of our lives. We're just not going to be a married couple anymore. And so she went off. She's in Italy right now for a month. And we just have this amazing, every few weeks we get on the phone and talk for 3 or 4 hours. And so in the end, we're off on different journeys. But we had to go through this deep, dark, scary place in order to get to this place of wholeness. So now as a recruiter, when people ask me my story, because a lot of people in the wine industry know I did a sabbatical for 2 years. They don't know what happened on it. So when I meet an executive and they ask me to tell my story, when I get to the sabbatical part and I tell the story about my marriage coming to a close, usually their jaw drops and their reaction is, wow, I don't even know you, but the fact that you're willing to tell me that story, that vulnerable story, I want to work with you. You know, there's something about that that is unique. I've never had another recruiter really approach me in that kind of authentic, genuine manner. And so I bring that, I call it balance of head and heart and left and right brain into the way that I interact with candidates and you know, sort of the winery owners and the CEOs and whoever else that I'm working with. That's number one. And then in terms of the actual way I go about conducting my business, because the recruiting and hiring model is broken, I'm not smart enough to fix it. But if you look at business in general, every functional discipline, sales, marketing, finance, manufacturing, whatever, every one of those has been re-engineered, not once, but typically three or four times over the last three or four years, with the exception of one area, recruiting and hiring. Recruiting and hiring is still limping along with the same old tools and processes like job descriptions and whatnot that they've always used, and they don't work anymore for the most part. We're in a very different environment right now, and you need a re-engineered approach to recruiting. Well, I'm not smart enough to do that myself, but actually before I went on sabbatical, I found a company in Southern California called the Adler Group, and they actually did some primary research with LinkedIn, and they discovered that top performers, A players, go about their job search process very differently than B and C players. And there are a couple things they care about first, and so they re-engineered the process to appeal to just top performers. So I'm the only recruiter in the wine industry who's gotten certified in what's called performance-based hiring. It's based on only identifying, engaging with, and then recruiting top performers. And then I'm the only recruiter in the wine industry who uses a behavior-based personality assessment tool, the Drake P3 I talked about. So that's a lot of talking on my part.
No, this is awesome. If you don't mind talking a little bit about the first part of it, which is, what is the process really like?
Which process?
You said that you're the only recruiter utilizes
performance-based
those two.
Yeah, so here's the idea. What they discovered through their research is that top performers care about two things before money. Mm-hmm. It's not that they don't care about money, but you have to address two things first, or they're never going to lift their head up from what they're busy doing, because top performers are top performers because they're focused on getting the job done. And as a recruiter or as a hiring company, if you're going to engage with those people, you can't just put out a standard job posting on an online job posting site. Some of the research that the Adler Group did discovered that there are two categories of full-time employees. They're what are called active candidates and passive candidates. The active candidates are the ones who are currently actively looking for a job. Might be because they just got downsized out of a job. But in addition to that, a lot of times the people who are active candidates, they're active because they can't hold a job. They've got personality issues that doesn't allow them to play well in the sandbox. They're not performers. There's those kinds of things. So if all you're doing as a hiring company is using job postings, the preponderance of people who are going to be seeing your job postings are going to be laden with these B and C players. You're not setting yourself up for reaching the A players, because they're over in that other category of what we call the passive candidates. And roughly 85% of full-time employees are in the passive bucket. About 15% are in the active bucket. So again, if you're doing a job postings, you're missing 85% of the potential population for your role. So what the Adler Group did is they discovered there are two things these top performers care about. Number one is, what are you going to challenge me to do in my first year if I do lift my head up, engage in your interviewing process, and ultimately take the job with this new company? If those challenges in the first year line up with where I am in my career and what I'm ready to be challenged to do next, I'm much more likely to lift my head up and engage in your interviewing process and seriously consider this job. Second thing they care about is, if I do take a job with this new company, where is my career going to be 3 to 5 years down the road? And if it's not on a better trajectory than the one I'm on right now, why should I waste my time? Then they care about money. And so what I do is, before I launch a search, I sit down with the hiring manager and the hiring team, and we work through what are the top 6 to 8 core accomplishments that whoever takes this job has got to be able to successfully tackle and execute and deliver in the first year. And from that, I actually can now derive my interview questions so that I can actually be interviewing not just on a job description, which is like a checklist of skills and experience. And the reason why job descriptions don't work anymore is, too many people who are involved in hiring and recruiting and interviewing, they look at that job description and then they start interviewing candidates and they do like a mental checklist. Okay, check, 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 check. They have all these experience and they have all these skills. And that means they're going to come in and be a top performer. The problem is, the job description doesn't define the job. You have to define the job. So this exercise that I learned from performance-based hiring by forcing the hiring manager to figure out what are the year one accomplishments, that's the job. So now I can interview to verify that people have actually done those jobs or something similar that will translate into that. So right there, it significantly increases the probability that we're only talking to people who can actually do this job. And then the second thing I do is I work with the hiring team to figure out what we call an employee value proposition. This is borrowing from marketing, like a value proposition. So the idea is, let's figure out what are all of the reasons why this is going to be a great job and a great culture and a great experience for a top performer. And so we have a little section that has bullet points. You know, it's an awesome proven team, and it's a family that's committed to long haul. They're not going to be selling out the Constellation, and you're going to get a chance to be the architect of this new department. Or we identify those kinds of things so that it helps a top performer to, in their mind, imagine what life could be like 3 to 5 years in the future. And then I put that all together in a really comprehensive document called the Performance Success Profile. So before I make contact with any prospective candidates, they get to review a 6 to 8 page performance success profile that gives them a background on the company, context on the business, on what's happening in this business, why this search is open, defines the first year core accomplishments, it defines the employee value proposition, it defines all the characteristics and traits that a top performer needs to bring to the table. What I'm finding is that it de-risks the recruiting process in a couple different ways. Number one, when a top performer gets their hands on that document and they read through it, there's enough meat in that document that they can start imagining themselves in the job. And if their emotional response is, oh my God, this is what I want to be doing next, they get excited. And so they literally are chasing me, and they get so engaged in my interview process, then they get much more engaged in the interview process with the client, that it sets all of us up for a lot higher probability of success. The other thing that comprehensive document does is, if it's what I call a smoke and mirrors or a wannabe candidate, the ones who look good on paper, they present really well, they're super charming, but they're oftentimes a tall hat with no cattle, they can't deliver the goods, and you don't discover that for 4 to 6 months, you know, on the job. Those people, when they read that comprehensive document and see how overwhelming this assignment's going to be, they get scared and they self-select out, and they never even bother to waste my time. So it accomplishes that also, to de-risk the process. And then the final thing that it does, by having the hiring manager identify before we even start talking to candidates what the year one core accomplishments are, what I found is that before I was doing this, and what I've seen in lots of other recruiting experiences and hiring experiences, is that the hiring manager typically doesn't figure out what they're going to have their new hire do in the first year until the first week of orientation. So the candidate's already been hired, they're already on the job, they're in orientation, meeting everybody in the company and learning the systems and processes and tools and all that. And that's when the hiring manager sits down and comes up with their list of, you know, sort of to-do list. Well, that's too late in the game, because what if that person that you already hired can't do that list? So this actually gets the hiring manager thinking way ahead of time. And then when the hiring manager and the candidate start the interview, they have a document they actually talk about and interview about what that first year is going to look like, so that when the new candidate that I place comes on board, I actually circulate that little subsection of my performance success profile with the incoming executive and the hiring manager to tell them, hey guys, look, this is what we had identified a few months ago when we started the search process that are likely to be the first year, you know, sort of activities. Even if this doesn't turn out to be the real activities, why don't you guys start having a conversation about this list here? And then figure out what the real is, tweak it, modify it a bit. So it starts the onboarding process off on a really solid foot, which is what so many companies don't do a good job with. So that in a nutshell, those are kind of the two core differentiators: performance-based hiring based on working with primarily top performers. And then also, oh, I didn't even talk about the personality assessment tools. Should I just go into that too?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, so what I found is that there was a book that was written in the 1990s called Good to Great, a guy named Jim Collins. And this is a group of consultants who wanted to understand why are some companies great and others aren't. And to cut it really short, they discovered there are something like 12 or 13 principles that all great companies share in terms of how they conduct business and how they function internally and externally.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palette Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.